Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. Tonight I'm your host as we discuss Prosperity Consciousness 101 with our very special guest, Frederick Lehrman. Frederick is an author, a teacher, and the founder and director of Nomad University. The Buddha says, with our thoughts we invent our world. Indeed, our thoughts and feelings play a critical role in what happens to us. This includes our thoughts and our feelings about money and wealth. Frederick's teachings on prosperity consciousness are the finest I know on how to align our personal thoughts and feelings about money with creating a prosperous world. Since leaving Wall Street in Washington, I've been amazed at the extent to which those of us whose lives and work are not directly involved in managing money have fears about money. Those fears and misunderstandings reduce our power to create a more beautiful world. When we have negative feelings about money, we do not learn about it and we do not master the use of it. That makes it easier for those who do understand money to take advantage in unethical ways. In short, our fears deny us an understanding of how money works around us, a critical mapping tool to navigate and create our world. In our audio seminar, Navigate the Falling Dollar, we address the importance of the wealth creation process to the creation of sustainable local economies. Support for wealth creation is critical support for the development and growth of healthy businesses, farms, and the entrepreneurs who can help us shift to an investment model that nurtures and supports life. Tonight in Prosperity Consciousness 101, Frederick will help us understand how our feelings and thoughts impact how the money works in our lives and how we can change our feelings and thoughts to change our financial situation and our community. Then we will discuss specific actions we can begin to take in our lives to reinforce a new attitude about money. Tonight's interview with Frederick is part of our recommended core curriculum for those who want to change how the money works in our lives and communities. Before we can start to change how our money works, we need to first change how we think and how we feel about how our money works. Understanding this is one thing. Understanding how to do it is another thing. Nobody can explain the how of prosperity consciousness better than Frederick. I've heard him speak several times, and I listen to his tapes, Prosperity Consciousness, repeatedly. I always learn something new every time I listen, and I know I will listen many more times. Nothing makes a long trip in the car more wonderful than a Frederick Lehrman CD. As always, we'll have a question and answer period beginning after the first hour, when Frederick and I will take questions posted by you, the live audience, before and during the program. You can post these questions at the link provided at the event resource page or send these questions or any comments on the show to info@solari.com. That's info@solari.com. So, Frederick, it is such a privilege and so marvelous to have you with us. Shall we begin by talking about the relationship between our prosperity and what's going on inside of us?
I think we should, and I have to point out right from the start that every single word that we use is already prejudiced by our unconscious beliefs. So when you hear the word prosperity, every person listening to this call probably has quite a different picture of what that represents. And the point of trying to understand the relationship between the mind or our thoughts and our prosperity or our relationship with money is that money is one of the best mirrors to reflect back to us how our unconscious mind is working. We have conscious intentions, wishes, hopes, desires. We set out in business and in our professional lives in order to succeed in relationship to money. But if we have thoughts buried underneath the conscious level, which are in contradiction to our conscious choices, the result will be confusing. The result will be that there will be less benefit than we feel we deserve because we don't know what other underlying thoughts are kind of sabotaging us. So the whole purpose of prosperity consciousness is to get your subconscious in line with your conscious mind in relationship to your beliefs and concepts about money.
Fascinating.
Now, there are three principles of the mind. And then in the psychological approach that I like to use, there are three levels to the mind. And it's a rather subtle business. I think that we walk around, each one of us, with our heads in a cloud of self-perpetuating beliefs. And until we happen to fall out of that cloud, either go above it or drop below it, we have no idea what else is out there. That cloud is the sum total of all the rumors we've heard since we were small children, beliefs that were expressed by members of our family, the conditions that we grew up in, the financial stresses that we observe going on between our parents and in people around us, all of this becomes part of that cloud of money consciousness, money beliefs. And until we see some other clear possibilities and clear understandings, we're kind of trapped by that thing. And we can make valiant efforts, but it's not even really a question of luck as to whether we get out of it. That cloud is so powerful that people who, for example, win the lottery, the studies have shown that within 18 months, they're right back where they were.
That's because amazing.
Has made them lose the money or spend it unwisely because the condition that they were in was so unfamiliar to them. And unfamiliar means not like your family. It's really a fascinating, very personal story here.
Now, the three kinds of minds, what are the three kinds of minds? Because this helped me tremendously,
is
breaking it out this way.
Well, the Polynesian psychological system, which I ran across pretty much by accident when I was reading around in different spiritual traditions, seems to me to be the one that helps us understand best what actually goes on. They talk about three levels of mind, which in our terminology we would call the higher mind, the middle mind, and the lower mind. Now, these are not necessarily value judgments. What they mean by the higher mind is that it's a mind that works at a very high energy level or a high frequency level. It's like a powerful laser beam of thinking, something that's very different from what we normally experience on a day-to-day basis. The middle mind has a middle range of energy, and that would be equivalent to our conscious mind. So that's the mind that we think is our own. That's the one that we hear and use intentionally and consciously. And then below that is the lower mind. And the lower mind works on a very light, subtle kind of energy. It doesn't speak to us continuously because it's drowned out by our conscious mind. If we can get the conscious mind to be quieter, sometimes we will hear the promptings of the subconscious.
So the lower mind is like the subconscious mind.
Yeah, the lower mind is the subconscious mind. It comes through to us in dreams and through meditation and anything that will quiet down the noise. It's like I like to say that, you know, when the vacuum cleaner is running, you don't hear the faucet dripping. The vacuum cleaner is your conscious mind. You've got to learn how to quiet it down and listen to what's going on in the background. In the background are all your emotional beliefs, not logical, not rational, but associative emotional beliefs about yourself and about money. And that's where your true sense of value is formed.
Right.
So in order to achieve what I call financial balance and a good relationship between your inner values and your outer values, you have to have harmony between the middle mind and the lower mind, at least. The higher mind is already in harmony. You can assume that that higher aspect of yourself knows what's best and even seems to know the past and the future, according to the Polynesian way of thinking about life and about healing and about time. But the middle mind, the conscious mind, is the one that seems to be running the show or driving the car. And it pretends to itself that it knows what's going on, but it has a very limited range of vision.
I find whenever I get really stuck, if I, you know, with prayer and meditation, I try and go into my higher mind.
Mm-hmm.
Problems that seem unsolvable are so easily solved.
Well, I'm using the term higher mind a little differently because the Polynesians say that the higher mind is so powerful that if you go directly into it, you'll basically lose consciousness and pass out. And that's what happens when people have a sudden enlightenment experience. They just see a flash of light and they pass out. Then they wake up like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. They wake up a changed person.
Right.
Or it's like being struck by lightning. But the lower mind, being less massive, being less rigid, and being more liquid and flexible, is not afraid of that energy. So the way to reach your higher mind is through the subconscious, through the lower mind.
Uh-huh.
Meditation. And then the information comes to you in a filtered form, which is safe for you to see. Now, this method of psychology, certainly did not invent it. It was well written up in a book called HUNA, H-U-N-A, which is Hawaiian for The Secret. HUNA is called The Secret Science. And the author was a man named Max Freedom Long. And the books were written in the late 30s and are still available. So if you want to follow up on this psychology, that's where I would send you.
It's very hard, you know, if you grew up in America, certainly if you worked on Wall Street, it's hard to believe that how we feel about money impacts what happens to us with money. But it's really true, and maybe you could give some examples.
Well, there are many examples. As a matter of fact, everything seems to work like this. You can take five people and put them at the same starting line with exactly the same opportunity in front of them, and you'll get five different kinds of results. The opportunity is the same. The starting position is the same. But there is a factor which we like to call luck or talent or who knows what it is, which seems to make one person succeed and another one fail.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the outside condition. We seem to think that the universe is random, and if we're lucky, things will open up for us, and if we're not lucky, we will be thwarted again. But when you start to experiment, and everything I suggest is really from an experimental point of view, try it out and see what happens. When you experiment with changing your fundamental thought, the foundation of your actions, then you suddenly find that you get a different kind of result. And by fine-tuning the thoughts, you can fine-tune the results and progressively increase the sense of luck in the universe. The universe starts to go your way. Now, just as an example for people, everybody's gone through periods where nothing seems to work for them. And then they go through other periods where everything seems to just work out magically. That kind of experience would indicate that there is something going on, a relationship factor going on between how we are and how things work for us. And what I'm suggesting here is that by experimenting with that, by removing negative attitudes and impulses and beliefs, you may find that life seems strangely magically to get easier and to start working better. It's a profound process, and some people do it through spiritual practice and meditation, but I'm saying that money is an excellent thing to meditate upon. It gives you very quick feedback.
One of the things that I think is so marvelous in your tapes, Prosperity Consciousness, is when you describe, you redefine money as energy. Perhaps we could go into that a little bit, sort of what is money, and how do we think about money in a way which is compatible with prosperity consciousness?
Well, money is really an interesting thing from the abstract point of view. The money that we use, pieces of paper and little round pieces of metal, if you leave that money alone, it's not going to do anything. The money is a reflection of your instructions to it. The money didn't do anything to anyone. It's how it was used. And what those pieces of paper represent, they are actually symbols of your own energy, your own creativity, your own actual life force, the fact that you wake up in the morning and you can begin to be aware. Now, that particular gift of consciousness is not something that you had to pay for and buy in the store. It's not like like a car where you have to go buy a battery, otherwise the whole big machine doesn't work. It was free. It came with the vehicle, with your body. And what our wealth is simply an extension or proper use of that original gift. And most of us find this kind of simple on one level, but also hard to experience, because we think of the universe as being uncaring, not interested in us. In fact, it's really a hostile place, and it's out to get us in some way. We have to constantly fight to survive. That is a choice, that belief system. And if you think that way, you will experience more of that kind of resistance in life itself. But there are a lot of people who have a much more innocent point of view. They wake up and they're grateful for the fact that they're awake again and it didn't anything. And then they follow that impulse with that same kind of, as Reverend Ike years ago used to call it, the attitude of gratitude, saying, thank you, I'll take some more of that, please. And that life force begins to expand because you are accepting it and you're not questioning it. And as it expands, your intelligence increases because your intelligence is a function of the flow of that life force through your nervous system and your ability to reflect. So it's almost like saying you don't have to do it alone. The universe is on your side. And by relaxing and settling down on that support system called the universe, you find that everything else that you were trying to do suddenly becomes more doable.
Right.
The maxim that I give to people is only you can do it, and you don't have to do it alone.
Right.
You can do it with the universe, and I always like to say that the universe should be spelled Y-O-U-N-I-V-E-R-S-E. way of
so how do we clear out? How do we clear out our mind of feelings and thoughts about money that really are working against us and not with us?
Well, I go through many, many different methods in my Prosperity Consciousness course, and all of them work. One way is to free associate. If I just say, take out a piece of paper and write the words, money is, and then write descriptive words to finish that sentence, just a long list of words, without trying to make it good or bad. See what comes out of your mind when you simply take the, you know, open the flow and say, money is, and see if, whether you get a lot of words coming quickly or there's silence. But if you get a lot of words coming quickly, then look at the list after you filled up a page and see how much of that is positive and see how much of that is negative. And it gives you a kind of a quick overview of your habits of thought concerning money. So if somebody says money is useful, that's a neutral kind of statement. If somebody says money is hard to get, well, that's another point of view.
Right.
And it's a question of which of those things do you want to keep in the garden and which of those plants do you want to remove so you can grow something that's a little more nourishing.
Now, one of the things you've done for me that has been a life-changing event is help me to understand affirmations. Is now a good time to talk about affirmations?
It's always a good time. And the reason it's a good time is because all of our thoughts are affirmations. Every thought that
right.
is affirming a belief or an attitude or a point of view. So if you say life is good, that's an affirmation. If you say life is bad, that's an affirmation, although it's a negative or limiting affirmation.
Right.
You're affirming or adding energy or making more firm a belief. So affirmation, as I'm suggesting that we use it, is simply a thought that you choose to think consciously. It's not a habit. It's a thought that you choose because you like the results it will produce.
You know, I was always trained it was a matter of great integrity to be accurate. So I've always had a hard time with affirmations until I started to study your work, because I'd start the affirmation and I'd say, well, that's not true. And so you introduced me to the what I call the affirmation about affirmations, which is my affirmations work whether I believe them or not. And what I found is using that sort of global affirmation before I start to do the affirmations, it just kickstarts all the affirmations. It's wonderful.
Right. Well, you are the thinker who's thinking those thoughts, and you have the choice to override old habits and old beliefs experimentally. So my suggestion is, you know, if you don't think affirmations work, that's fine. Try using this one as an experiment. My affirmations work for me whether I believe they will or not. Write that phrase down a few times. Put it on a card and stick it on your wall. So you see it a few times a day. And then go ahead and be as dubious as you like, because you see you've already set kind of a circuit there, which is going to say, it doesn't matter whether you doubt this, it's going to work anyway. And it's as simple as that. It really is. Now, it doesn't mean that the affirmation works instantaneously. People have to persist for a certain amount of time before they begin to see results. But after you see results, then you don't have to struggle to believe anymore. You just say, oh, I know how it feels now to change my thought pattern, and I get a sense of how long it might take for me to begin to see a result. Now, it's not just a question of writing a new affirmation on the wall like a piece of graffiti and, you know, whitewashing over all your old limiting thoughts, like affirmations can't work. That's a limiting thought, right?
Right.
You don't just paint that over and pretend it isn't underneath the new one that you're sticking there.
Uh-huh.
Use the new positive thought as a kind of a flashlight to go up into the dark areas of your mind and say, what thoughts do I have in here which are contradicting where I want to go? So if I say my affirmations work and I hear my mind say, no, they don't, try to go follow that voice, find the thought, say, why don't you think they're going to work? And bring that out into the light. And then experiment with changing that limiting belief, just arbitrarily changing it to something more open. And then one of the things that I talk about, which is not specifically about money, but very easy to remember. Some people say, well, I can't succeed in life. I can't be rich. I can't get what I want because I'm too stupid. Right? That's a thought that they may have taken on early on in life because some teacher or parents or someone told them, oh, you're just stupid. And they kind of gave up on that and accepted it as true. So the opposite of that thought, the thought that would release it, would be to say, well, I'm smart. But if you're very skeptical because you think you're stupid, it's going to take a long time to make a change by just thinking, I'm smart, I'm smart, I'm smart. So what I'm suggesting is that you change the context. This is a technique which, once you grasp it, becomes very easy to figure out. Instead of just resisting the negative or limiting thought, step to a place where you can make a statement which you know to be true, which makes the original limiting thought irrelevant. What I mean by that is, instead of just saying, I'm smart, which is the opposite of I'm stupid, why not try the thought, my way of thinking works? And someone says, well, you're stupid. Say, that doesn't matter. It works anyway. Because, you know, there are a lot of very stupid people out there who are quite rich.
Right, exactly.
You know, so the smart, stupid thing is just one way of looking at life. And if it's not working for you, step beyond it and say, my way works. And the original problem sort of dissolves. It's a kind of a, I call it sleight of mind, not sleight of hand, where you trick your old mind into following something else until it gets out of its problem without even knowing how it did it.
One of the things I love is your idea, if you want to dig out sort of what your sort of negative things are, you write down your affirmation and then you write yes or no next to it. Do you remember that one?
That's right. The way I suggest doing it is writing these down is easier than just thinking them over and over in your head. But when you write your affirmation, your positive thought, put a vertical line down the right side of the page, and in that column there, which I call the response column, make a short, brief note of the echo or the response or how well this new positive thought was received by the audience in your mind. Your mind is filled with lots of voices.
Right.
Not just your own. I mean, your parents are in there, your teachers are in there, your friends are in there. And when you say, I'm smart, and then you hear this big chorus say, no, you're not, you're an idiot, write that down in the response column so that it's not hidden in your mind. Bring it to the surface, and gradually, over a interestingly short period of time, you'll see some remarkable changes in how you look and how you feel, and people will come up to you and say, you know, you look smarter.
it's unbelievable. It works. It's magical.
Well, it is magical, but for me, magical is normal. Magical,
right.
Ordinary. I mean, it's magical that you wake up in the morning. That's really magical.
Yes, that is. And your mind is clear. That's really magical.
Right.
Now, you have affirmations for earning, for saving, for spending, for investment.
Yes, you asked me about the energy, money as an energy flow. And I'll very briefly explain what that means. The value and the power to do whatever you do doesn't come from money. It comes from being alive and being conscious. So how do you earn money? Well, the way you earn money is you take some of that surplus energy that you have beyond what you need for your own survival, and you contribute it to the well-being of the people around you. You serve someone in some way. You give them something that they want, which you don't need for your own survival. It could be a service, it could be an item, some kind of physical thing, or it could be information. But when you share this to people, their natural response is they feel enhanced by what you've just contributed to them, which you got from the universe as part of your surplus life force or intelligence or awareness. You pass that on to them. And then their natural energetic response is to be grateful for that, to appreciate it because they feel better. The secret to earning is to be able to let people acknowledge you for the contribution you've made to them. There are a lot of people who contribute, but they're not very good at receiving. So they never earn any money. You have to practice receiving, which is a natural response to what you've given. It's very much like remembering to inhale after you've exhaled. There's two sides to every cycle. In order for you to give, there someone has to be willing to receive. And then if you don't let them give back to you, of course you're not going to receive and they're going to be stuck with the energy. So the health of a community is based on the ability to give when it's appropriate and receive when it's appropriate. And that's what makes for a healthy economy. So that's the earning side of the energy side of the earning cycle. Now, some people earn plenty of money, but they don't feel like money is good or safe or disreputable to have a lot of money, so they subconsciously get rid of it. They spend it, they lose it, they give it away, and they're always at a break-even point. So there's a function called saving money. when that energy comes back, when you've contributed your services to someone and they acknowledge you and you receive it in the form of money, don't be embarrassed about it. Allow it to accumulate around you. And some people are afraid to save money because when they think, I have $100,000 in the bank, they feel like they're too exposed, they're actually too bright. It's like a very bright star in the sky. Everyone's going to look at me because I've got all this money. And because of limiting thoughts about safety and about themselves and other stories which come from their life history, they try to get rid of the money in order to disappear back into the general obscurity. So savings has to do with self-esteem and being willing to be seen and willing to be valued. But then there are people who make money, save money, and then they never spend it. They hold on to it. And this is like the people that you hear about who die, an advanced age of 80 or 90, and they never went anywhere and they never did anything and they were very frugal. And then their family comes in and is clearing out the house and they find this box under the bed with several $100,000 in small bills. This actually happens. So these are people who have never mastered the spending function of money. They have limiting negative thoughts which block them. What you have to realize in order to spend money is that money is useless unless it's in motion. If it's just still, it is inert, it has no power at all. So when you put money in a savings account, it's not just sitting there. The bank is using it. It's moving around. Now, if you understand this, every time you spend money, you're actually enhancing the prosperity of everyone around you, of your community.
Right.
But when you spend money, one of the affirmations connected with spending money is that every dollar I spend comes back to me multiplied. Means when I put energy out into the pond of prosperity, it creates motion, and that motion creates benefit for many people, and eventually that healthy dynamic movement is something I can benefit from. So when you think of spending, don't think you're losing anything. You're actually just keeping the circulation going. You're keeping the water fresh. It's not getting stagnant.
I don't know if you've ever played the game when you were a kid when you tried to keep the balloon up.
Yes.
Yeah, so everybody taps the balloon and keeps it up, and you're just, you're all working together to keep the balloon up.
Right, and when someone grabs a balloon and holds on to it, the game is over, and it's no fun.
Right.
When people grab their money and put it in the box and never look at it, it's no fun for
right.
anyone.
Exactly.
It's fun to play with. And then the last part of the money energy cycle is the investment level. Once you've got earning, saving, and spending mastered, then what you do is you take your surplus money, which you haven't spent, which has come back to you as a reward for the services you've done, which you've saved, therefore it has accumulated, and you send the money to work in someone else's project. That's called investment. So while you're still over here creating your own everyday contribution, your money is working somewhere else, and it's contributing to someone else's project. That's like bilocating. It's like being in two places at once, and a good investor is in hundreds of places at once. They keep putting their money to work in other people's projects, projects which they can relate to, can endorse, and can understand. And in that way, you begin to get an organic and integrated, healthy money economy.
It's funny. For many, many years, Frederick, I was very wealthy, and I always paid my bills on time. I had this obsession with paying my bills on time. And then when I went into this very extraordinary period where I spent $6 million on litigation, I ended up in a situation where I had creditors and no money. And my bill file used to drive me nuts until I listened to your tapes, and I realized, wait a minute, I don't have to pay the money until it comes in. And so now my bill file is sitting underneath my checkbook, and in fact there's a prayer book on top of it all, but it's all in a hierarchy that was completely rearranged by you explaining to me the importance of rethinking the earning, saving, spending, investment flow.
Very good. Well, I'm happy to hear that story. It means that you listened carefully and actually applied it. Because all
well, but it was amazing. I was just, I was mixed up. I was thinking, it was a very draining way of thinking. I was like, whoa, no, I've got this backwards.
Right.
And
we're all like
your
that.
Point of view and the whole thing changes.
You think, oh, I have so many bills, I'll never have enough money to pay it.
Right.
Those thoughts are self-perpetuating.
Right.
But what you need to do is realize that your bills are simply communications from people. They're letters saying, we hope you'll pay us. But you have to tell them that I will pay you, but first I have to have some income before I can have an expense. There is no expense, which means money going out, until there is money coming in, which is called income.
Right.
You don't have to worry about your expenses. That's a waste of energy. See, that's putting putting your mind in the wrong spot. Concentrate on income, then you can have expenses. You have the luxury of expenses once you have some money to spend.
Well, let's say we understand, we go through a process and we try and understand how we feel, and we do a series of things to clear out our negative assumptions and thoughts about money and prosperity. We use affirmations, and so let's say we've done the internal work. How then can we start to change our actions? What are some of the things we can start to do in our daily life to try and inculcate these new attitudes?
There is a wonderful thing about the human mind, which is that the human mind is very adaptive. It learns by modeling itself on other people. You put yourself in a new situation, within a couple of hours or days, your entire frame of reference has shifted to adapt to the new conditions. Now, if you understand that your subconscious has the talent to adapt to a challenge, then all you need to do is create for yourself the appropriate challenges and wait for yourself to adapt. Now, in the course, I recommend several different kinds of things that have to do with these four phases of earning, saving, spending, and investing. On the savings side, we generally have a backwards view of banks and savings accounts. We think that we're going to put the money in the bank because then it will save us. You know, we think we're saving money, but actually we hope the money will save us someday. There are some fundamental thoughts and actions which are absolutely critical. Without them, you will never become wealthy, and with them, you will inevitably become wealthy. The basic thought is, part of all I earn is mine to keep. Part of every dollar I earn is mine to keep. If you don't have that thought, the money will be gone. If you do have that thought and you begin to save a little bit of it, you're going to find out that you have more and more. So I ask people, well, how much money has passed through your personal control since you started earning money? And just take a guess. How many hundreds of thousands of dollars have you been paid and spent, paid and spent, paid and spent? Where is it? Where did it go? And my next question is, do you think you would have perished if you had lived on only 90% of that money? Would you have somehow made it through? And most people realize they would have made it through on 90%. And if you had saved 10%, you'd have a lot of money now.
Right.
That's a minimum, and it's an easy number for the mind to think of. 10%, you can just calculate it in a flash by moving a decimal point. You don't have to use complicated math. So if I give you $1.60, how much are you going to put away? 16 cents. It's that simple. And once you develop arbitrarily a kind of a game where you use savings accounts as a way of managing your money, not where the money is going to save you, but where you manage the money, where you give the money certain jobs, certain roles, then you will find that suddenly you have traction, and this whole sense of slipping and sliding on a difficult slope where avalanches are coming down on you, that will disappear. You will find yourself being able to go where you want to go, but not until you tell the money what to do. So my rule for my students is at least 10%. Must be put aside and must be divided into four different functions, and that's represented by four bank accounts or four categories which you honor, and each one has rules which you follow. And if you simply do that, it may seem like, oh, this is a big problem. Once you start it, everyone I know who's ever done this has suddenly said, this is so much simpler than what I was doing before. I don't have to think about things anymore. I know exactly what to do with the money when it comes in, and everything is taken care of. So that's the kind of structure where you take the money and you put it in a format that's external, visible, tangible, involves actions in time and space, and it reinforces the new internal structure of your mind. You don't do it all mentally. You have to have an external form that represents that internal change. So that's one type of thing that you do. There's another way of keeping track of how you spend money. Most people are totally unconscious about that. And I say, if you have money sitting around with no purpose, it will get spent. That's why people don't have any money, because they just put it down, and then there it is, and they spend it.
Right, and that's why you have the budget game.
Yeah, the budget game is very simple. You just take a little pad of paper with you, and every time you spend money for a month or so, you just make a little note. And you say, I spent 60 cents on bus fare. You don't have to itemize it any more precisely than that. I spent $11 on food. And at the end of the day, you just throw all those scraps of paper in a box. At the end of the month, you take them out and you organize them by category: food, transportation, clothing, education, and so on. And then you add it all up and you see that, all right, I spent $2,000 this month, and I spent this much on money, this much on food, let's say. I spent this much money on food, and that represents 26% of the money that I spent. So you're taking the amounts of money and eventually getting proportions out of them. Once you have that game board created, then you play what I call, I think of it as the budget game. You say, how can I, let's take food, for example. How can I eat better this month while spending less money?
I just listened to all your food stories last night, so I'm laughing.
And you come up with some phenomenal ideas.
Yeah.
Really, everyone who succeeded in any kind of business has been thinking this way. So you want to apply it to every aspect of your life. What this does is that when you eat better next month and you spend only 20%, and than you did unconsciously the month before, because you think about it a little bit, what do you do with that 6%? The 6% can be added to the intentional savings or intentional purposes of things that you really want to do. If you don't have investments, the reason you don't have investments is because you never set money aside for the purpose of investing. So you want to have an account called investments.
I've known people who are very wealthy, who lived wonderful lives, and I've known people, I have a series of friends who don't want to be bothered to earn much of an income at all, and so they live like kings and queens on almost nothing. It's amazing. But both groups have an attitude. They're masterful at the budget game.
Yes, some people are talented and just do it without thinking, and that's usually because they had some good models or they had a time in their life where they had to kind of take control of this. These ideas that we're talking about today and all the ideas on my course are very, very primary. I think that this kind of information should have been taught to all of us in high school, right around that 14 to 16-year-old range, because it would have made the rest of life so much easier. I didn't learn it that early, unfortunately.
How did you learn it?
Well, it was kind of one of those fortuitous circumstances. I had a student who wanted to go listen to a lecture on prosperity consciousness, but he was going to be out of town, so he asked me to go to listen to it and tell him what I learned there.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, I never would have gone. And I got so excited by what I heard that, it became a major focus for me for several years. I studied it intensively for 2 years, applied all of the techniques which I talk about, proved to myself that they worked, and then since then I've been doing lots of things with money and around money, but I hardly ever think about it anymore because the ground plan was set in place a long time ago.
One of the things you talk about in your tapes, Prosperity Consciousness, is how many of us are uncomfortable with salesmanship and being good at salesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
First thing is that some people say, well, I don't like sales. I don't like selling things. Everything you do either has one of two functions. Either you're a buyer or you're a seller. You walk into a room at a party. You're either looking around to see, well, who's in here that I want to get to know? That's a buying function. Or you're walking in there saying, I hope somebody notices how interesting I am and comes and talks to me. And that's a selling function. It's no different than that. So all that selling is in the highest form of it is when you have something that's useful, that's valuable, that's meaningful to you, and you just let other people know that it's there and that they can have this too, then that you give them the opportunity to sell whatever it is to themselves. And it works just as well that way as trying to interrupt somebody's lunch or dinner by calling them up and then seeing if you can keep them on the phone long enough to get them hooked. I mean, that's a very, very primitive way of selling. And,
another concept you have is service, the idea that the way to become prosperous is to be of service to other people. And in fact, their payment to you is really an expression of the value that you're providing in your service.
Exactly. And that's what I was saying before, that
right. There's
two sides. You need to see where there's something that you can contribute to. And then at the same time that you're contributing, keep the door open for people to acknowledge that contribution by paying you. Those are the two sides.
And that's what I call the pricing function.
All the issues that come up when you consider that That's what I'm talking about the limiting negative thoughts that have been lurking in the shadows of your mind that are keeping you back. You want to pull those out into the light and say, we're taking over the property. I'm going to renovate the whole building. You can stay, but you have to stop, you know, throwing the garbage out in the hall. You have to you have to become good tenants if you want to stay in my mind. Otherwise, I have to have...
I love your story about raising the rent on your tenants.
Exactly. And yes, that you own the real estate called your own mind.
Right.
See? But it's been taken over by people who have been hanging out there for years without paying rent, and they're exhausting you. I am to change the rules, and that's really where it starts. Now, the only other thing I should say is that, if you go out in the world and you try to do all these great things, you know, I see all these courses being sold everywhere. Many of them are very good about how to make millions of dollars in real estate with no money down, or how to use all the tax plans, you know, and the Roth IRAs and so on and so forth. All of that is fine unless you have a self-defeating psychology operating in the background. It's not going to work for you.
Right.
But if you have the opportunity and the willingness to be a success and to not feel guilty about it, then it will work for you. And
it also requires going at it. One of the things I love in your affirmation, your whole explanation of affirmation, is you talk about, you know, this is going to take weeks before it really kicks in and is working.
It can take quite a while, but there's no hurry.
Right.
Take it easy and relax and don't struggle with it. You see, people come to me and they say, well, how many times should I write these affirmations? You want to write them. I said, well, I've written them like 2,000 times a day. I said, you would only write them 2,000 times a day if you think they aren't working.
Right.
That's a sign that you don't think that's going to have any effect.
Right.
If you really are sure of this, you can write it once and it'll work. But in between those two extremes, there is a comfort level. Go to the place where your mind is still focused, and when you start to get tired, stop.
Right.
And be gentle with yourself. You don't need to hit yourself over the head in order to feel better. That's not how it works.
Another point you make that I love is the power of having an ethical intention.
Yes. The basic principle is that if you think of yourself as separate from the universe and you have to survive in the face of a hostile environment, then you're basically cutting yourself off from your life support system. It's like holding your breath and seeing how long you can stay underwater. If you realize that your prosperity interlaced with and totally involved with the prosperity of the person next to you and the one next to you, next to them. In fact, your whole extended community, in fact, the whole planet. Then your egocentric way of thinking of yourself changes, and you suddenly become identified not only with your own physical body, but with your community and with the environment and with the atmosphere and eventually with the whole solar system and beyond. And so when you say I, you're not thinking of yourself as this little separate piece. You're thinking of yourself as a focal point of awareness within an enormous organism which knows a lot more than you ever need to consciously know. And every part of that is contributing to your well-being. You couldn't function for a minute without that support. So the truth is you have always been connected. You've never been out there in the vacuum of space without your spacesuit, because you wouldn't last very long. So we're all connected, but we're pretending that we're separate. That's where we get the breakdown of the economic flow and the sense of proper use of the resources that we have. So your ability to be prosperous is inseparable from your realization that we all are already in a prosperous universe. Those
right.
two must go together.
I think that's one of the hardest things for folks to believe. And I've had the luxury of having been an investment banker who really studied enough about how the money works to know that the universe really is prosperous, and we're behaving in a whole series of ways to essentially prevent it, so that there's a natural abundance that can be unleashed if we will change our behavior.
Right.
It's phenomenal, but it's really true. And part of it, Frederick, is, you know, part of creating a prosperous world is having a culture where I enjoy watching you become prosperous. Because if you look at liquidity in financial systems, it doesn't necessarily hit everybody all at once. So if we all go to work, and I enjoy seeing you prosperous, and as you're prosperous, you delight in investing in me or somebody else's project, and then they are prosperous and they invest in me, well, that's what kickstarts liquidity, is this culture of prosperity thinking.
That's right.
But it only happens if we're all thinking in ways that really support prosperity.
Right, and it's important to also realize and remember that prosperity and money are not identical.
Right.
You experience prosperity with no money at all.
Right, absolutely.
And that prosperity means the ability to function freely, effortlessly, conveniently in the physical universe. If you have millions of dollars and you're trapped in the top floor of your hotel like Howard Hughes, that's not prosperity anymore.
Right. What was it? There was one time where you tell about being at a dinner, and I think you had people who were very wealthy down to people who had but there was no correlation between how much money they had and how they felt.
Right, and what I said about that experience, which was very enlightening for me, is that you can have anxiety at any price.
Yeah.
Not a question of the money. It's a question of the value you attach to certain numbers. That's really all that it is.
But it's interesting. You can't deal with that anxiety unless you can talk with other people about money. And what I find is in America, those you'll see the most intimate conversations occur with people, but not about money. Money's kind of a secret. Whatever my money problems are, I keep them to myself. And I think part of the problem is we all feel so isolated, and we're trying to deal with it on our own, and we can't.
It's true. You by definition can't deal with it on your own, because money comes from people.
It right.
doesn't come out of an ATM machine. We seem to think that it does, but somebody has to. And there's a whole series of people to people to people, person to person interactions, which are responsible for the shifting and movement of the stuff we call money. If you're not willing to deal with people, then you're never going to be able to really enjoy your money.
Right. Is it possible for you to share any of sort of the success stories of some of your different students? And I know you consult with people too.
Well, it's fascinating and challenging. Every story to me is like solving a mystery. You know, I think one of my big influences when I was a kid was Sherlock Holmes, and how he could look at a situation and notice things that nobody else paid any attention to and figure out, you know, what thought caused this crime.
Right.
So when I work with individuals, I like them to have studied my program so that they have a fundamental structure within which to think. But very often, the combination of thoughts, which is keeping them locked up, is still not clearing up. It's right in front of their nose. But if they're ready to see it, then I can notice it, because it's kind of in the forefront of their mind. And I remember very recently I was in Malaysia, and I was consulting with some Chinese businessmen one at a time, and I didn't really know till the end of the week that all these people that I was having my consultations with were all self-made millionaires who were heads of companies that had a minimum of 500 employees each. They were very humble, very, very real people. They had no ego attitude at all. But the most interesting story to me was a man who had built up a pottery business. His father was a potter, and he had learned to make pottery, and then he had taken it step by step to a place where he was the largest supplier of garden pots in the world.
Wow.
The head of that company. And he supplies all, you know, whether it's Walmart or Smith & Hawken, the high end and the low end of garden pottery, most of it comes from his factories in Malaysia. And he's very successful, and his kids all went to universities in Japan and in England and in the United States, and they're all lawyers and doctors, and they don't want to make pots. he's ready to retire. He's 70 years old, and he's happily married to his first wife, and he just wants to go traveling around the world with her and go back to making pottery as an artistic thing, not as a commercial thing. That's what he wanted to do, and he couldn't figure out how to get out of this business that he had built, because he couldn't pass it on to his kids.
And that happens a lot. You know, you know, a guy like Henry Ford, he sold his first car because he wanted to get the money to make a new one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you fall into something because you love it.
Well,
not because you intended to make, and all great companies never are great. You know, they never have a goal of trying to make money. The goal is to, you know, to make something wonderful.
Well, this particular story, though, I want to show you how the mind works. It's a very complicated story, but I'm going to make it very short. He could not surrender the business in good conscience to either his kids or a group of his old, most loyal employees, even though he knew they could run the business. He just was afraid that if he left, there would be no one to take care of it. And when we looked into his past and his story, the key to this was that when he was born, his grandparents were already dead. His father and mother, their parents were gone. So he never experienced having grandparents. And so the thought, I'm the parent, I have to take care of this company, right? He never had the concept of having a grandparent, so he could not step into that role. He couldn't become the grandfather of his own company and let the kids take over. And once I pointed this out to him, I could see, because he was a very wise man, I could see this almost chemical change in his cells. His face changed and relaxed. He got this smile. He got a new look in his eyes. And he said, I got it. He said, now it will work. I can let it go. And I can let my employees and my daughter, who's a wonderful accountant, she'll handle the numbers. But I'll let the employees handle the creation of the product. And I'll travel around the world with my wife and stay in touch with them just like a grandfather.
Wow.
And it was as simple as that. That was the one piece which was not allowing him to let go. So that's the kind of thing which, even though it has nothing to do with money, is expressed by the way we handle money.
Right.
That's the profound thing.
Right. Well, money's just a tool, and so it gets caught up in all of our strategic desires.
I'm going to give you sort of one observation, which I hope everyone will kind of meditate on, because it takes years to really grasp it. What we do with money when we grow up and we are self-sustaining and not being taken care of by our parents is we unconsciously use money to recreate the stresses that are familiar to us from childhood. So we take our money and we make it arrange our lives in such a way that we feel like we did when we were growing up at home as small children. This is very often completely unconscious and suppressed. But that's why I always look back at very early memories and patterning to see if there's a key there that will show how this, how we've been locked in to a certain level of success by, not by money, but by a feeling of stress. And if stress were to disappear and you were to be entirely relaxed and free of all pressures from now on, how would that feel? And a lot of people, when they look honestly at that, they say, oh, I don't know if I can handle that. That's a sign that you are living with a familiar pattern of stress, and the money will serve that pattern. Until you allow yourself to be prosperous in the sense that it's safe to be relaxed, it's safe to be happy, it's safe to be wealthy, it's safe to be acknowledged, it's safe to be loved, until those values are direct and real for you, you will be holding on, and money will become a tool to keep you stuck.
Right. Well, we're coming up on the hour, so before, I just want to remind everybody, if you would like to post a question, there's a link at the event resource page, or you can email us at info@celeri.com. I think it's now's a good time to just sum up, Frederick.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're saying is that we have the power with what we feel inside and how we think about money to impact what's happening to us with money and to impact our sense of well-being and our prosperity. And as you said, you know, prosperity is not just about money. It's about a sense of well-being. And I want to remind our listeners, we hope to have the MP3 file of this up on the event resource page by tomorrow evening. And I will tell you, having listened to Frederick's tapes many times, you know, I just have to listen to you again and again and again. I was telling somebody this morning, it's like reading the Psalms. You always learn something new every time you read it or listen. So feel free to check back and listen to the file as often as you like. We also have a link at the event resource page so that you can link to information on how to order Frederick's products or to arrange a consultation. And we also hope to have those tapes, some of the tapes, Prosperity Consciousness, up at the Celeri store by the end of the month. And again, you can link to all of this from the event resource page. So to sum up, Frederick, any comments you'd like to make?
Well, the thing that I can say is that, you see, my background is not like yours. I recognize that you have a profound knowledge of the sort of higher end of the money world, the banking and the government and all of these aspects of which we put under the label of economics. I come to this from a background in the arts as a musician, and I tried to stay as far from money as I could during the first part of my life because I didn't want to be like my father at all, and he was, you know, an investor, and we used to listen to the stock market during dinner on the radio.
During dinner?
So, for me, money was not part of my world.
Uh-huh.
Until I went to that seminar. And then I suddenly realized, well, there's an artistic way of dealing with money.
Right.
And then I later found this wonderful quote from Igor Stravinsky, the composer, who said, once you've mastered art, the only thing that is inartistic is not to master money. And the
say that
idea
again?
That your art is going to be better if you're a starving artist is just not true. Not true. I decided to no longer be a starving artist, and I thought I'd experiment with this, because one of the things is that if you change your mind and you don't like what the results are, you know, if you become prosperous and hate it, you can always go back to being a starving artist.
Well, but I always tell people, if you don't want your money, just, you know, donate it.
Yeah, you
invest
can.
It. You know, build things.
A lot easier to save the world if you have lots of money to throw around.
Yeah, that's what I think.
And it happens faster. I mean, and if you have a spiritual issue about money, I talk about that a great deal on the tapes, but money is really almost like a representation of divine power.
Right.
If you want to, you know, move a mountain, you have to have a lot of faith to look at the mountain and say, move. The only other way to do that is if you have really a lot of money. And you can get all the machines in there and move the mountain, and we do it all the time. That's how roads get built. So we just want to eliminate the distinction between the physical and the energetic, between the mind and the body. These are all part of a continuum. And you want to be...
Right. And part of what I believe is you have to do both. In other words, the best system is one where the energetics and the knowledge of the material world work, you know, dovetail and work together. And especially when it's combined with an ethical intention, which I think is so powerful.
For me, it was a great revelation to realize that if I really wanted to be fully enlightened, spiritually clear, I had to stop discriminating against physical reality. Physicality is just as spiritual as the void. Yin and yang is all about. And so by seeing it all as equally important and equally spiritual, I suddenly came into a new kind of balance, and it all began to fall into place. So I do recommend this wholeheartedly, especially to people who are on a spiritual path, not discriminate against money.
Okay, well, we have a series of questions, so are you ready to go to questions?
Sure.
Okay, the first, we've got two questions from one of our skeptics. If things don't work, you would say, well, you're not using the system properly. How would you ever know that the reason for you not being successful at achieving your money goals is not because you don't follow the system properly, but for other reasons, even things beyond your control?
This is a good skeptical question. And what I can say about that is that if things are not working, you have to ask this question. What thought, if I had wanted it to be like this, if I had wanted it to turn out in this way, which is limiting or unpleasant or difficult, what thought would I have been thinking that would have produced this result? And bring that up to consciousness. Like, if you know, if you're having trouble because people are constantly stealing money from you or embezzling or something, right? Then mm-hmm. You say people are crooks. That belief is being reinforced by what you're observing. That's why I say we live in clouds of self-perpetuating beliefs.
Right.
What you have to do is step out of that cloud enough to say, what thought could I think that might produce a better result? And try it out, like a new pair of shoes, just see how it works.
What I find is many of the things economically which are shrinking prosperity can be discovered and changed if we're operating in a state of prosperity consciousness, but that we then start to engage in communicating with each other. I mean, many of the examples I hear on your tape are really an example of somebody you know, getting much more into cahoots with everybody around them and engaging with them about, you know, either what's going on or how they can be useful.
Partially, that's because when you have a group of people who commit themselves to making some kind of positive change, you kind of drop into a larger mind, a group mind awareness, and other people will be able to see your limiting thoughts almost faster than you can. So if you trust enough to let other people know what you're going through, that sort of expanded consciousness of the group often leads to group breakthroughs. But this is another very important thing. As you change, you will find yourself having to let go of the old relationship networks, which have been negative.
Right.
So for a while, you may have to step away from some old friends and even family because they will try very hard to hold you back in the old pattern of struggle. Because
right.
That's what's familiar to them, and you know, misery loves company. You don't want to be miserable. Get around some happy people.
I remember after you know, basically I'd had my fortune wiped out by this process with the Department of Justice, everyone in my family said, well, you'll just have to adapt to not being wealthy. And I said, I have no intention of adapting to not being wealthy. I'm going to be very wealthy again. And they fought me on it for about a year or two, and then within about 2 years, they all started to say, you know, everybody started to talk about, well, you know, Catherine's going to be very wealthy again.
by keeping your own mind focused, then magically people
uh-huh.
were agreeing with you, even without arguing.
Oh, it was funny, because what I realized was we were going through a mental warfare process, where the other guys were trying to, you know, persuade me and all those around me that it was hopeless, you know, which of course it wasn't, but you know, so you really had to watch your thoughts.
Yes.
It was amazing. There was another time when, at the most dire moment, they seized our offices and I had to keep everybody working. And so I said, well, you know, our equity in the company has been wiped out, but the movie rights and the book rights are still worth something. So the more horrible these people are, the more our book rights and the movie rights, you know, will be worth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so funny because during that week, they just try and do all sorts of things to bust everybody's morale, and the worse they were, the happier everybody got. And I don't think they could figure out what was going on, but it was because we had stuck to a prosperity consciousness. It was amazing.
It's a perfect example of looking to see both sides of the question.
Right.
It's the dark side, and then it's going to look darker. You can look at the light side, and it will look lighter. It's up to you which is going to make you more effective. And I
right.
find that, you know, I always tell people, you can make yourself very sick if you just meditate on becoming sick. Try it. You know, you have to be a fool to do that, because you know intuitively you could create a serious illness by just thinking about, I'm getting sick.
Absolutely.
So why not? But no one will take the other choice of meditating on feeling good and getting and feeling even better. And they don't do that because they think, well, that's not fair. That's too easy. Here's two affirmations. If it's easy for you, it's right for you. That's a
right.
shocker, isn't it? You didn't learn that one in school.
It's no. No, I went to a Quaker school. Absolutely not.
Easy for you. If it's easy for me, it's right for me. Try that one out for a while.
Okay.
And the other one is, I feel good now. You know, most people think, well, I feel great, so something bad's going to happen to me. No, change that habit. The new habit is, I feel good now, so I know I'm going to feel even better soon.
Right.
That's just as logical.
Yeah, our skeptic has another follow-up on that question. Another way to ask this question, under what circumstances would you admit that what you are claiming is not true? If you cannot describe when that is, then really what you are advocating is more like religion than science.
No, I actually had this point of view myself until 1968. I know exactly when I changed. Because I used to think about all this stuff. I said, you know, if magic is real, if life is good, then it'll change and then I'll believe. A miracle will happen. But no miracle ever happened. So I decided as an experiment to shift my belief and simply say, well, magic is real. Good stuff happens unexpectedly all the time. I tried it out, and within a month, it was starting to happen more and more. And I had designed this experiment. I said, for 6 months, I'm going to just have a positive attitude and see what happens. It got a lot better. At the end of 6 months, I said, well, I guess I've seen what happens. Should I go back to the old way just as a control and be negative for a while or skeptical? And I said, why? Why should I do that? That's pretty dumb. So I stayed with this unreasonable belief that life is okay. And you know, I don't think that I have been punished for that.
One of my favorite quotes from Carolyn Casey is, "Our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism."
That's actually quite a sophisticated way of saying it.
Right, right. And so what I find is...
Oh, there's so much to be upset about. But what good is it going to do you? So I don't want to say that this is a religion. It's not a religion. You have to examine what is religion in the first place.
I think what you're saying, it's an art.
It's a choice.
Right, it's a choice.
It's an experimental choice. Try it out. If you don't like it, you can always change back.
The next question is, what about the people who make money in ways that hurt others and the environment?
Well, this is a function, I think, and I agree that this is what gives money a bad name, but it's not money's fault. It's the way people are. When people use money at the expense of the larger self, called the environment or the society or other people, it's because they are coming from a fundamental attitude of scarcity and of greed. Greed is based on scarcity. It's based on the thought there isn't enough to go around, so I better get most of it soon. Otherwise, you know, I'll starve. And that type of drive for money's sake, power for power's sake, is so dangerous now because the planet has become so small.
Right.
Get away with it 100 years ago because communications weren't so rapid. But now, if something happens in one part of the planet, everybody knows it immediately. And also, if you pollute the environment someplace, you know that eventually it goes all the way around the planet, in the air, in the water, and so on. So we are dumping so much stuff into the environment that being selfish is really suicidal. We're reaching a point where that whole mentality of money for survival and control and power is becoming truly self-limiting. And it's one of these hard lessons. And I wish there were more people thinking this new way that I'm subscribing to, because I think those changes would happen rapidly if people would relax and not be so tight and not be so rapacious about the landscape and about their communities. But all of it is based on scarcity and defense thoughts rather than safety and abundance thoughts.
Next week, our audio seminar is Building Real Wealth with Franklin Sanders, where we talk a lot about the difference between making money by creating real wealth and making money by destroying wealth, which is the kind of what you're talking about. We have one quick question, and let's see if we can do it quickly. There are places in the world where it is not safe to have money. Also, there are a lot of places where it is not safe because of the way that folks with money use that money. Any comment before we close?
Yes. I've been to a lot of those places. And where, for one reason or another, let's say crime and petty theft was the norm.
Right.
So far, I've never been robbed. I was one of a group of 57 people in a town in South America. We went out for a walk the first day. Everybody wandered around the city for an hour or two, and 55 people came back having been robbed.
Oh, my word.
I was one of the two that wasn't robbed. And a lot of the people that were robbed were bigger and stronger looking than me. So it is a very interesting thing. It doesn't mean that it can't happen to me at all. I just so far have observed that you bring safety with you into your reality. You know, I'm not going to start worrying about it, because worrying about it would be to actually fall into the trap of attracting to you. See, fear, this is...
Attracts.
Think about this. Fear is a prayer for something you don't want. It's like obsessively thinking about something which you hope won't happen. And by doing that, you actually make it more real.
Right.
It's unhealthy. So I can't give a very simple mechanical answer to any of these points. There are very good points, but the question itself reveals the problem. You must be in a state of mind where that question doesn't arise.
Right. Well, Frederick, this has been a real pleasure. It's hard to express how much your tapes have just brought joy into my life, and particularly on those long car rides. I'll notice I'll start laughing and enjoying something, and I'll turn in a traffic jam, and somebody will be looking at me in horror because I'm having such a wonderful time listening to your CDs. Anyway, so I want to thank you tremendously, and we're going to close with an invocation from our prayer team leader, Ileana Obadiah. Ileana, are you there?
I am, and thank you so much, Frederick. That was just magnificent. And usually we'll say a prayer or an invocation, and what I really feel to do tonight is actually to review some of the affirmations that have been spoken so that each person in their own way can absorb that, begin to work with that in an active way, and that we can begin to do that as a collective. Even if everyone on this call doesn't know one another, we are one in community. And so we begin with the fundamental, which is that each one of us has the choice of whether we want to move ahead and experiment with making the kinds of changes in our thinking that Frederick has been talking about tonight, that we can open to the possibility that I bring my safety with me into my own reality. And so just be that with that for a moment. And as I repeat some of these affirmations, just let your spirit respond to them in a way that is true and real for you, because freedom always comes from the beginning point where you meet with the truth of your current reality, and it can be changed from there. The universe is on my side. And so I can now settle down and relax into that as my own true reality. Only I can do it, and I don't have to do it alone. As of tonight, I can and I choose to begin a new money energy cycle in these areas of my life, in earning, in saving, in spending, and investing, so that there is a powerful free flow that is in abundance and grace and is a blessing to everyone around me. My prosperity is interlaced with the prosperity of the entire planet. And I have always been connected to the universe that supports my well-being in every area of my life. The natural abundance of this universe can be released through my new thoughts, through my choices, and through my responsible and ethical actions in this world. So I am now, from this point forward, even more active than I have ever been in creating a culture where this can happen and where I can enjoy seeing everyone becoming prosperous. The culture of prosperity is in my life now and in my world. And I am no longer discriminating against physical reality. All aspects of my life, spiritual, physical, inner and outer, are equally important and equally spiritual. And so I'm willing to experiment with changing my thinking and my habits to create this across a wider and wider spectrum of my world. And finally, it's easy for me, it's right for me, and I seek now the things that feel easy and right. And I join forces with all of the others in my world to create this as my reality and as our reality together. And I give thanks in an attitude of gratitude for what is right here, right now, in my life, and all of the love that is underneath that. And with that, we all bid you good night. Thank you all.